Many of you know I'm a true advocate for taking supplementation to optimize your health, and one of the best things you can do is choose the right collagen. Collagen is a building block to your entire body. I was introduced to Sparkle Wellness product Skin Boost Plus about a year ago, and I've been taking it ever since. Now they've launched a new bone strength product that I'm super excited about. New Osteo Boost Collagen is formulated to improve bone mineral density, something we all need to think about as early as age 40. Made with award-winning collagen peptide known as Fortibone, the product really has led to meaningful results for people who need significant improvement in this area, including those suffering with fractures or broken bones. OsteoBoost is a great choice for anyone over the age of 40 to reduce the risk of bone mineral density loss, a major precursor to the diagnosis of bone-related diseases. Right now, you can get any of the Sparkle Wellness collagen supplements from Amazon or from their website, lovesparkle.life, and use my code DRFIT for 20% off. That's DRFIT at lovesparkle.life for 20% off their new product, OsteoBoost. Welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman. Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Jamie. Hope you're having a fabulous day. Welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. It's so wonderful to have you here. Thanks to everybody that's listened to our previous episodes, downloaded them, left your reviews, shared them with all your friends and family. We appreciate you guys doing that so much. Well, today on the Fit and Fabulous podcast, I have a wonderful guest, Esther Bloom. She is an integrative dietitian and menopause expert, you guys. In the past 27 years, she's helped thousands of women master menopause through nutrition, hormones, and self-advocacy. Bloom is the best-selling author of Cave Women, Don't Get Fat, Eat, Drink, and Be Gorgeous, Secrets of Gorgeous, The Eat, Drink, and Be Gorgeous Project, and See You Later, Ovulator. Ooh, say that 10 times. Any topic that regards to menopause, we are going to talk about today. Esther Bloom, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Jamie. I'm really stoked to be here.
So everybody has a story that got them to where they are today. Give us a little bit about kind of your life and background and how all of these topics became your passion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I grew up in a very medical family. My grandfather was one of the first graduating medical school classes of NYU in 1920 or 21. And he practiced medicine. He was like the tonsil king of Brooklyn. So he took my tonsils out in his house in Brooklyn. He had an operating room set up. Gosh. And he trained my grandmother, his second wife, to be the anesthesiologist. So like she put the ether mask over my face. Wow. And it was like, so, I mean, talk about like just having, you know, a frontline experience with medicine. And then my father was a dermatologist. My mother was a nurse. So we always talked medicine. So I knew it was my calling, although I did not want to go to medical school, much to my grandfather's horror. And so became a clinical dietitian, which is pretty much a med school degree, just no physics, which was really fine by me, and a little less chemistry. So, you know, the science, I'm always a science nerd and always all about solving the puzzles of someone's health. A lot of people go into nutrition because of their own struggles. I actually went into it for the academics and then later on was like, thank God I have these tools as I go through my own menopause journey, but also as I help my clients. So when I first started out in private practice, you know, I was in my 20s, but I was getting menopausal women coming to me with all of these problems. And we started out doing intermittent fasting, and we started doing, you know, grain-free, dairy-free, paleo diets. And we started really optimizing lifestyle pieces and strength training and all the things that you advocate as well in your practice. So that's where it all started. And then, you know, as more and more research comes out about hormones and how beneficial they are and not how scary and cancer causing they are, now it's, you know, a couple of years ago, I was like just at my utter limit of hearing the stories in my private practice of these women, just the rampant gaslighting that goes on in medical offices is so egregious. And I decided to write the book because I realized how much gaslighting impacts our ability to listen to our own bodies. Like we question ourselves and say, oh, you know, I really think it's my hormones, but my doctor says, no, it can't be your hormones. So I guess it's not. I guess I'm crazy. And I just kept hearing that story. And I was like, enough, I cannot do this. And one night sat down, you know, one of my colleagues was like, you know, your book is probably here. It's, but this one's probably ready to be written. And I sat down and wrote the outline in 5 minutes. And I was like, here it is. So that's why I wrote See You Later, Ovulator, to just give women, to open the kimono on my practice and give women the tools and be like, this is how you're going to advocate for yourself. Here's all the solid research for you. Here are all the tools you need to get through menopause. And no, this is not in your freaking head.
Absolutely. I just had a woman this week that was in my clinic who had really been blown off by her previous provider. She said, listen, I am having what I think is night sweats. I'm getting hot and sweaty at night. She wasn't getting a lot of daytime symptoms, but she was just having trouble losing weight. She was feeling brain fog. She just wasn't feeling right. And her other provider said, well, I think this might be menopause. You should try some black cohosh. That was literally what she was told to do. She was completely dismissed, not given any other option. And by the way, this woman is a fabulous candidate for hormone replacement therapy. But I see this day in and day out, and I'm an obstetrician gynecologist, and they're not blown off by, I mean, they're blown off by other OBGYNs. They're, you know, this is a real world problem. Okay. So your most recent book, See You Later, Ovulator, obviously very attuned to menopause. Your other projects though, what are some of your other books about, and what were your other areas of special interest prior to diving into menopause?
So my first book was Eat, Drink, and Be Gorgeous. And the whole motto of the book was your body may be a temple, but who says it can't be a nightclub? So I wrote it around the time of Sex and the City. It was really about living life in the balance. The illustrator drew a picture of me in like a super sexy streamlined lab coat with fishnets and heels. And I'm holding a martini in one hand and a bottle of supplements in the other. So, you know, it was really just getting people to have a healthy relationship with food, because we do not know what pleasure is in this country, right? We eat to lose weight. We don't eat because food tastes good. We eat because we're just worried about what it's going to do to our body and how can we make our bodies smaller and leaner. For some women, more muscular and lean and bigger, but for the majority, most women want to be smaller. So I wrote that as just an anti-diet book, as a very unapologetic way to say, people, if you dial into what you're eating and really listen to your hunger fullness cues, and if you're really craving something, you have it and you like take a couple bites and be satisfied with that. So it was really teaching people just how I live my life, quite frankly, you know, just really in a very permissive state. I don't, you know, I find diets really, again, turn off our ability to know intuitively what is right for our body and what isn't. So I really was like, take that all off the table and just be here now with your eating, enjoy, and really just taught people the foundations of good nutrient dense diets.
And then,
because it just, I studied under Janine Roth. Do you know her work? She wrote, So Janine Roth, for those of you who don't know her, please look her up. She is just so brilliant and healed her own relationships with eating disorders. And although I didn't have an eating disorder, at points I definitely had disordered eating. So I was like, I just want this to be permissive and fun and sexy and pleasurable. There were two more offshoots of that book that, again, had food logs, had different eating plans, really taught you to live life in the balance, pick up weights, the importance of protein and strength training. And then I wrote Cave Women Don't Get Fat, which was a paleo diet book for women, because, again, all the paleo diet books are written with a male audience or by male authors, but they don't incorporate female physiology, right? And one of the things I wrote about, the most interesting part to me was the intermittent fasting section, because of the 78 studies I looked at when I researched for the book, 13 were done on women. And no one, you know, now I feel like Dr. Mindy Peltz does a really good job of really helping women understand that Dr. Jade Tita taught me back in the day, like the first half of your cycle, you're way more insulin sensitive. That's kind of a better time to fast. The second half, you're far more insulin resistant. You know, you're going to feel a lot worse if you fast. The interesting thing is, in my practice, I find the menopausal women do the best on fasting. They can do long, you know, 14, 16 hour fast windows, or we do the 5-2 fasting, where for 5 days you eat, you know, regularly scheduled programming, and two days a week you have one meal that's 500 calories. And I usually say, save it for dinner. And my menopausal mamas do great on that because we're not having all of these fluctuations in insulin and hormones. It's much more of a controlled experiment. Yeah,
that is such the, I don't think it's that people don't want to, you know, have women participate in trials. I think it's just a lot harder when you have a mark that's constantly moving, especially menstruating women, but we make up more than half of society. And I resonate with that. I mean, exercise literature, nutrition literature, it's just easier to study men, and women are not men. It just aren't. But when you were talking about the differences in the cycle, so for people listening, the first half of the cycle, very estrogen dominant, a great time to hit the gym really hard, be doing more high intensity exercises. You have more resiliency essentially with all that estrogen. And when you lose it, which does happen with menopause, and also in the second half of your cycle, when it starts plummeting, you lose all those amazing benefits. And I was just pulling up my app. I'm cycle day 26 today, and I'm feeling all the luteal phase problems. You know, more blood sugar instability, really hunger, not recovering as well. Last night I was like real hot and sweaty from all the progesterone. I started wearing an Oura ring recently, and it's been cool to like track that and see the rise in temperature that happens when you have that. But, So let's talk about menopause. There's a woman listening right now who is like, I think this is perimenopause or menopause. I don't know. How do we define that? How do I know if I'm in that window?
So it usually starts with, well, the symptoms are fairly similar, but you usually I've seen women go through menopause in their late 20s, and I've seen it, you know, mid to late 50s, but on average, if you're in your mid 40s, you may notice like your PMS window is getting longer, where it used to be, you know, 3 to 5 days, or you feel irritable 1 or 2 days and you'd feel a little tired before. When you're in perimenopause, that window, you could feel sluggish like the last 2 weeks of your cycle, where the first half of your cycle and the second half are radically different. Your sleep quality tends to decline, especially PMS. You're just lying awake. You're not feeling well. Increase in irritability. Also an increase in the heaviness of your periods as your progesterone declines. It's no longer available or as available to oppose estrogen. So you can get these hemorrhagic bleeds, heavy clots, longer periods. Your periods can start to get more erratic. You may skip a month here and there. Certainly vaginal dryness before your period, low libido. You can feel hot or flash. So all of those can be present. But the other thing no one really talks about are the mental health changes, and anxiety and depression can be very real. You know, you really get that PMDD before your period. And a lot of women say to me, it's like, I'm a crazy person. My husband's, you know, saying like, who are you? What happened? And I cry constantly. And then I get my period and I'm happy again. I'm fine. So those are often, you know, telltale signs you're in perimenopause. But in my practice, I do run the Dutch, and it's controversial. A lot of doctors say, don't bother with the Dutch. It's expensive. Why would you do that? But it really gives a woman a very clear understanding whether or not she can start to bring in progesterone, even cyclically. She can bring in Chase Tree the last 2 weeks of her cycle, if she's a candidate. But I see plenty of perimenopausal women that are rock bottom progesterone, and no amount of Chase Tree is going to get those ovaries spewing out progesterone anymore. So they are candidates at that point for bringing in some progesterone the second half of the cycle. And that can be game changing because you know, the anxiety goes away, your sleep is not disrupted, and emotionally, that, you know, the situation's much more stable and you're not like bleeding like crazy every month. So that can be really instrumental.
Yeah. I think the conversation to have about the lab testing, no matter, you know, there definitely are accuracy and inaccuracy issues with doing salivary, urine, serum testing. But I think the difficult part, and I explain this to my own patients, is that in perimenopause, things are so erratic. Estrogen levels are, I call them psychotic. I mean, they're up, then they're down, then they're up, then they're down, then they're up, then they're down. And progesterone is starting to kind of fizzle. And I kind of explain, yeah, if I drew this on a graph over 5 to 10 years, this is what it looks like. It kind of gives women that visual. And that's the difficult part about testing, is we might test you on a month where you had ovulation and we get, oh, it looks good, right? So we always have to take it in the context of like, yes, what symptoms are you having? How often are the symptoms happening? Are they happening every month? Or is this like an every 3 to 4 month occurrence? And that's where, as a practitioner, you kind of put those puzzle pieces together for patients. But for somebody listening, that's what you have to understand about testing, is this is not a go to, you know, a provider and get a one-time check or lab draw or pee in a cup or spit in a tube or whatever it is and get a clear answer. You have to take it in the context of everything that's happening. And the, you know, and at the end of the day, there's still, you know, you're still left with, okay, now what do we do about it?
Yes.
So, yeah. Yeah. So I think that's the important conversation surrounding testing, but I'm a huge fan. I do Dutch occasionally, and I think it can be really helpful for kind of just taking like a 360 view of, you know, how do you metabolize things? Is there something that's grossly low that maybe we should check with serum and confirm? I think it also is helpful looking at the HPA axis with, you know, 24-hour cortisol, because that's not something that's easy to test by blood. And it gives me a way to kind of address circadian rhythm and other things like that. So I do think it has its time and place. Okay. So as women are kind of coming into this transition, you've mentioned intermittent fasting and nutrition. How do those things play a role in helping women feel better during this transition?
So a lot of women also get, you know, a lot of meno bloat or the meno pot. They're gaining a lot of weight overnight.
That's, they all say thing. That right here. It's, yeah, right here, doctor. I can't get it to go away.
That's right. And with declining estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, DHEA, you can become more insulin resistant and your cortisol levels can shoot up. I see very high overnight cortisols, like people not even in the range. They're like hovering way above the cortisol curve. And so it's very helpful to look at lifestyle. First of all, you can't out hormone your lifestyle choices. So if you're drinking 4 or 5 nights a week because you're trying to sleep, or it's just your habit while you're cooking dinner, that's a time to revisit it, because that does, every cocktail you have raises your circulating estrogen levels for 4 to 6 hours after you have it. So, and it will also exacerbate hot flashes and irritability. So your liver, right, has to choose, do I detox my hormones or do I detox this alcohol, which is really a toxin to my system? So estrogen detox gets a backseat while your liver's handling alcohol, and then it gets to you, the hormones. So be very careful with alcohol and caffeine, like sleep. You really have to optimize your sleep first. And I'm saying this even over diet, because if sleep is your metabolic mistress, right? So if you're not getting good quality sleep, that is one of the big rocks to fix. Even 2 weeks of poor sleep will cause you to be insulin resistant and store your food as fat around your midsection. So that means I tell you, the best thing for my sleep was like deleting social media apps off my phone, guilty. I know. I was like, so let me just check one more time. No, your brain does not need to be lit up like a Christmas tree.
I think we need those. I have those timers for my kids where their iPod, they don't have cell phones, but they have iPods, which let's just be real. It's a cell phone without cellular signal, but I have the timer on them where at 8 PM they literally don't function. They can call 911 and that's about it. I feel like we need that for our adult phones.
We do. We absolutely do. And I put my phone on silent mode after it's either 7 or 8 p.m. I can't remember anymore until 7 a.m. It's just silent. So no notifications. So that's step one is lifestyle. Okay. And deep breathing before bed is also really essential. Like meditation is just something I teach in my practice. I'm not a meditation teacher, but I introduced the concept to people. You don't have to be good. You don't have to live in an ashram. You don't have to be a good, quote unquote, good meditator. If you can breathe, you can meditate. If you've ever stared off in the distance when you're driving or you're in the shower, your alpha waves are cooking. You're actually in a meditative state there. So all of us are capable.
There's so many different like breath work, breathing patterns. Like how do you tell women to start? For somebody listening.
I usually give them my favorite Insight Timer meditations. It's a free app. And I just say, well, these are the ones I'm listening to. Go play for a while. And yes, there's 4-7-8 breathing. There's box breathing. There's so many. But I just say, just start with a guided one because you don't have to think. Someone else is just telling you what to do and you focus on that.
They usually put me to sleep.
Yes. Yes, sometimes they do, for sure. And so, and people say, I don't have time to meditate. I'm like, BS, you do have time to meditate. You're watching Netflix every night and you're on your phone. All it takes is 10 minutes. I like to do 20 because I'm an overachiever, but it takes me a while to really wind down. This brain is busy. So I need a good 20 to kind of chill out. but doing it consistently and understanding, it takes at least 8 weeks. That's less than 2 months, actually. It's 56 days, but it takes 8 weeks to reshape the fight or flight center in your brain. Okay. So diet wise, I love to have women make the following changes if they're not already doing so. Number one is optimizing protein. And I know you're a big fan of this. And protein really helps regulate your cravings, your blood sugar, your energy and adrenal function. A lot of people don't realize they wake up in the middle of the night because it's a blood sugar issue and a cortisol issue. It's so getting optimized protein during the day is key, and it will prevent you from over snacking. Like you know, we can all snort lines of chocolate chips off the counter, but no one ever is binging on steak. Like it's protein is the nutrient that shuts off hunger in the brain. So, but we also want it. We want to build muscle because women don't realize this time in life, we lose the most muscle mass in the shortest period of time. Unless you're sick in a hospital bed, this is the time when you lose muscle mass. So you want to make sure that you're, getting optimal protein during the day. And for most women, this is usually 4 to 6 ounces at a meal. So that's step one. Step two is
that's hard. Women, women have a lot of difficulty with that. They're like, God, that's a lot. And it really, I think, highlights how much they have been deficient in getting this into meals. Maybe they'll have an occasional meal that has that protein, but they're constantly getting these sub threshold levels.
Yes.
10 here, 10 here, 10 here, or whatever it is. And you really need probably upwards of 30 grams to stimulate muscle protein synthesis. And these women aren't getting it. Just a total tangent for just a second when you were talking about losing muscle mass. Saw this study the other day. And it looked at like 20 some year old guys. Imagine that in the study.
Shocker. But
they put them in a bed. They made them do 1 week of bed rest, never left the bed, gave them food or whatever. They weren't starving them, but it was just 1 week of bed rest. And then they measured body composition on these people and they did muscle biopsies and they were looking at what was happening with the muscle. And I can't remember the specific number without looking at the study, but it was somewhere in the range of like 2 to 3 kilograms of muscle that these 20 some year old men lost just by laying in bed. And I mean, that extrapolates out, right? Take that times 2.2. That's like, what, like 5, 6, 7 pounds of muscle just by laying in bed for a week. Wow. But they extrapolated that out and basically said, like, if you're in your 60s or your 70s and you get bedridden for some reason, you break a hip, you get in a car accident, you get pneumonia or whatever it is and land in the hospital where you're bedridden, and you could lose upwards of 12 kilograms of muscle. That's like 24 to 25 pounds of muscle, which means like when those patients lay in a bed and they lose a bunch of weight, it's not fat. Now they've lost the muscle and they've still retained a lot of that fat. Now they're fatter than they were before, right?
Yes.
Sounds weird, but it's like, yeah. So that's like what's happening when you aren't really making a valiant effort to stimulate that muscle tissue and give it what it needs from a dietary perspective. Sorry,
that's my tone
on muscle, but
no, it's so true though. I mean, even just, I go to the assisted living facility where my mom is, you know, and just, yeah, people are just sedentary all day and no one there has, you know, good muscle mass at all. And they're not feeding them enough protein and then they're not eating enough of it anyway, because they're not moving. So it's like a vicious cycle. So you've got to eat and move.
Well, and when you ask, and you know, movement's great, but I'll ask women, do you exercise? Yes. What do you like to do? Oh, I take the dog for a walk. Mm-hmm. No offense. That's not exercise.
Yeah. I say it's activity, but it's not exercise. And walking, listen, I'm a big fan of walking, but right. You got to pick up, you got to stress the muscle. You have to stress the muscle. So yeah, strength training is a must. And there's lots of ways to strength train as long as you do it. That's fine. If you want cardio, lift your weights faster. That's a great way to get your good cardio in. Yeah. And listen, there's anabolic effects to cardio too. I see studies all the time. They're like, cardio could still be beneficial. If you're someone though, who's like having very poor sleep and your cortisol is really high, think about your timing. Like I had a client who was not sleeping well and she's working out. And finally I was like, what time of day are you working out? She's like, oh, 4:30. I was like, move it to the morning. And boom, her sleep drastically improved. Shocker. And we also pulled back on all her cardio and she lost weight because her cortisol came down. So don't think you have to exercise harder. I'd rather see you lift weights with lots of good rest in between, or let your heart rate come down, wear a heart rate monitor, let your heart rate come down to like 90 or 100 and then do your next set. And then your cortisol will really, your HPA axis will repair itself, especially when you're sleeping better. So diet wise, the other things you can do, I do love, having my clients track what they're eating in an app. So let's say they're trying to get at least 120 grams a day of protein. And usually I say get, you know, a gram per pound of body weight if you're a healthy body weight, or a gram per pound of your ideal body weight if you're over your ideal body weight. So let's say someone weighs 120, right? So we have them get 120 grams of protein. The carb ratio needs to be lower in order for you to burn body fat and get rid of that menopause and sensitize yourself to insulin. So, you know, in general, carbs can be around 100 grams. And if you're lifting, and again, you can play with this. This is not a one size fits all approach, but just to get you thinking, or if you're eating 150 grams of protein, you know, do 120 grams of carbs. But you can also time your carbs around your workouts, which is my favorite way to get them. Or the other way I advocate for carbs is to have them at night before bed, because not before bed, at dinner time. Don't save all your carbs right before bed.
The last meal of the day,
because that will help you sleep. And yes, you may get a bump in insulin, but that's going to tamp down your cortisol so you do sleep. So we're talking—
Because actually you are more insulin sensitive in the evening than you are in the morning. So for people that don't understand that, when you wake up, you get something called a cortisol awakening response, right? It's like you came out of your teepee, you got to go hunt a buffalo. This is why I think morning is the best time to work out, because that your body is like, that's when it's ramped up. It's ready for that. But you're very insulin resistant when you wake up because of that cortisol. So the morning time is not the time to have cereal and Pop-Tarts and bagels and sweet potatoes and oatmeal and all the things. as your cortisol comes down in the evening, you're actually more insulin sensitive. And so I totally agree with that statement, pushing carbs to later in the day, especially around, around movement and exercise.
Yeah. And you know, we're talking the good carbs, the complex carbs, the sweet potatoes, some quinoa. If you tolerate beans and lentils, winter squashes, you know, vegetables, those are all the good carbs.
Not Oreo cookies and ice cream. And let's see, what are the other things my patients like to eat after dinner?
Oh, when they're bored? Everything. Yeah. Yeah. Chocolate, whatever.
Pretzels, those truffles. Popcorn.
Yes. It was hilarious. I was out to dinner with like two of my dear nutrition friends. And one of them was like, and she's teeny tiny. So talk about metabolic individuality, right? She's tiny. She looks like she's 105 pounds soaking wet. And she eats popcorn and Parmesan. And literally, she's like, I'm literally eating it practically as I'm falling asleep. And I find it so interesting. And I was like, oh my God, that cannot be good for your digestion. But she sleeps really well. She goes to bed 8 or 9. She's up at 5 doing her yoga and whatever. So it really depends on the individual. And the more muscle you have, the more insulin sensitive you are. And then, yes, you have more flexibility metabolically with your carbs. But the other thing is, you know, again, people like this just feels overwhelming out of the gate, just start with a really high protein breakfast. You know, I strive to get 40 to 50 grams of protein, at every breakfast. And it really just changes the outcome of the day. It just does. And I can tell when I'm traveling or things are a little off and I don't get that protein in my day, it's like I'm craving, I'm hungry, I'm tired. But if you get that protein in the morning, your neurotransmitters, your dopamine, serotonin are going to be sky high for the day. You'll feel amazing.
Yeah. And women will say they'll just attempt to be eating 90, 100, 120 grams. And they're like, I'm so full. I can't eat anymore. And I'm like, welcome to satiety. Like now you know what it feels like to get that signal, where most of us are like overfed, but undernourished. And I know that was me for years. It was just like, all I think about was my next meal or snack. It was just like this constant intrusive thinking. And it really gives women like this freedom finally from like thinking about it. It makes intermittent fasting way easier too when you actually eat adequate amounts in your eating window.
Yes. And also for me, it gave me freedom from cravings. I mean, I ate chocolate like every day when I worked in the hospital, I knew exactly which candy places I was going to hit on the way home because I constantly craved chocolate at 4. And I was always so tired because what was I eating for breakfast? Bagel and cream cheese and coffee. What the heck was that?
Totally.
Terrible.
Okay. So we've talked about nutrition. We've talked about how women need to exercise. We've talked about meditation and breathing. Can we touch on alcohol again? This is such a common question I get from patients. They're like, listen, I just have like a glass of wine occasionally. Can we circle back around to that? Because I think it's something important that women need to really start to have an introspective conversation with themselves about.
Exactly. So, you know, the introspective conversation is really around finding out why you want the drink, right? Is it some people are just like fun, you know, or if it's my unwind time, but a lot of times it's like my self-numbing time. And so I totally recommend, again, that you really think about the stresses in your life and what needs to change, because this is the age where, you know, I'm 52. I can tell you, you know, aging parents or passed away parents are part of the picture. Raising a teenager and running a business with a team that I manage, right? That's a lot on the plate. So it becomes a question of what can you delegate? Can you hire a college student to help you do your laundry a couple times a week or cook some basic meals, right? Or can you say no? What can you take off your plate? What are your priorities? What are your absolute priorities? If your priority is to work out every day and to eat a lot of good meals and cook ahead, You have to structure your day to do that. But often structuring your day to do that takes away that stress of the ruminating things of what you didn't do, right? So managing your life, like tightening things up. There's a great book I recommend for this called The Seven, it's by Stephen Covey. It's old, like The Seven Highly Effective Habits of Happy Families. Seven Habits of
Highly Effective People. There's a couple versions
yes. of it. Yeah. So I love the version for the families because as women, right, we don't know how to ask for help, or we don't think to ask for help, or worse yet, we think no one can do the job as well as we can. So we may as well do it ourselves. Well, my fellow martyrs, I'm here to tell you that that is a recipe for burnout, resentment, anger, and drinking at night and drinking your feelings. So it's really vocalizing your needs, handling your stress through breathing. If you want a substitute, I use these lovely tinctures. There's a company called Wild Women. It's Judy Greer's company. Actually, it was developed by a naturopathic physician. And I love their tinctures because they crack me up. Like the names are like Unanger or Unworry, right? And they're just adaptogenic herbs. And you take a tincture and you put it in your wine glass and you drink that instead. And it's often the ritual, not the ingredients, that matters the most. Because here's the thing too, if you think you're going to change your body composition drinking, rarely do I see that in practice. I'm not going to say I never see it in practice, but the people who are able to drink and still lose body fat or stay lean are working out 2 hours a day and very spare on eating and a lot of fasting. But metabolically, you know, alcohol slows down your thyroid. It's helps you store, you know, those calories as fat. It's very, makes your liver kind of sluggish. And
yeah, I mean, you list pros and cons to it. And there's literally no pros. The only one I could even possibly think of is social engagement. You know, maybe you get a little serotonin because you've gone to happy hour and you're with your girlfriends and you're getting that serotonin because it's a social thing. And that is one thing I experienced. I gave up alcohol on October 1st for a full year because I wanted to experience every day of the year, every time of the year, and just kind of say, does it add value to my life? Does it take away value? And very early on in this experiment, I noticed this loss of serotonin when I went into social situations where I was like the only one not doing it. But I found that if I had a glass in my hand, no matter what it had in it, I didn't have that loss of serotonin. So you're talking, it just resonated when you say like, put the tincture in there. Like, it's just like, we use it as like a pacifier. It's just like a kid, a toddler, when they're frustrated, they don't know it. They need a pacifier. It's the exact same thing, but there's so many cons to it. I mean, it makes it hard to build muscle. It ruins your sleep. It makes you more insulin resistant. It's literally a carcinogen. It shrinks your brain. I mean, it is like so bad for us, but it's such a pervasive thing in our society. And I understand why it's hard for people. I also think that I was listening to this mastermind talk the other day, and this person had posed a question. They said, what do you deserve in life? And I think my brain initially went to like, right, I deserve happiness. I deserve a nice house and a car and vacations. And I deserve all these things because I work really hard. And when you think about it, you deserve nothing. And when you deserve nothing, you become very grateful for what you do have. And I think that it really resonated with me. We do things like we think we deserve this meal or this snack, or we deserve a glass of wine. We've worked so hard. We're just lying to ourselves. We're using these behaviors as pacifiers to avoid something in our life. And once you figure out what it is that you're avoiding, and it's usually a toxic relationship, a bad job. I mean, there's usually something that in your life that you're not addressing that pushes you towards those behaviors.
Yes. Brilliant. And even, often we're just avoiding painful conversations, or we're unhappy in our marriages, but we're not communicating why, which creates deep foundational cracks. So it is, I'll tell you this too, you know, not drinking. I still drink socially occasionally, but I notice just so much more creativity, clarity, energy, right? And just really having the bandwidth to dial into my emotions and to journal those and think about what, to really take time to think about what I want and what's working and what isn't. And when you're drinking every night, no way are you going to have the space held for you to create that, to create the life that you are striving for, even if you don't deserve it.
Yeah.
But that's the thing you've got to have. You got to adult, people. You've really got to adult and be really present in your own life.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk. Women have now, they're in the perimenopause. They're trying to dial these things in that we've talked about. They've hit menopause. It has officially happened. Is there anything that changes in the advice that you've given them in this perimenopausal? Now they're officially menopausal. Is there anything that changes?
Yeah. Well, now you really want to bring in those bioidentical hormones at this point in time, because the research shows the most benefits come with the early intervention and addition of bioidentical hormones. It is shown to support and be very protective of bone density, cognitive function, and cardioprotective effect. So you really want to make sure that you're not just bringing in estrogen. I see a lot of doctors just slap women on estrogen, and that's not how nature works. Nature does not offer hormones in isolation. It's a team, right? So it's not a soloist, it's a concert is a better way to think about it. So you want to bring in estrogen and progesterone, but also testosterone. Women don't realize that testosterone is actually the dominant hormone in our body, and often is what is converting to estrogen. So we want to make sure we bring in testosterone, and we want to make sure that we are bringing in DHEA if needed. And these can be given, I'm sure you do this all the time, right? These can be given orally. They can be given topically. They can be given vaginally. So, and I just was, there's a sexual wellness urologist who I was reading her. She had research studies on her site about how vaginal estrogen prevents UTIs. She was like, every woman above the age of 45 should be on vaginal estrogen to prevent UTIs.
Yeah, genitourinary symptom of menopause.
Oh my God.
We'll highlight it at the end of today's podcast when we do the semen analysis. Yes. But yes, very safe, very effective. And literally every single woman listening on this podcast can be on it for the rest of her life until the day she dies with really minimal, no risk at all.
Hallelujah. And the other thing is, you know, ladies, get your pelvic floor and start in perimenopause if you haven't or before. Mm-hmm. A lot of us really have pelvic floor issues that are a holdout from childbirth, right? Which no one ever told me about pelvic floor rehab after childbirth. I just thought it was normal to have painful sex and to pee many times a night. And that's actually not normal. It's not normal to pee your pants when you sneeze, cough, or laugh, or are lifted or jumping up and down or running. So you've got to get your pelvic floor checked too. And estrogen, again, vaginal estrogen can really support pelvic floor health, but stretching and strengthening, working with a pelvic floor PT, it's also really key, because otherwise, yes, you can have major issues with incontinence as you age. And that's not something that has to be inevitable at all.
Yeah. So menopause, once those ovaries turn off, aging is accelerated. So, you know, it's like your car was sliding on the ice. Once you hit menopause, it is like careening off of the mountain. And so I just had two sex experts on the podcast. And if people haven't listened to those episodes, they gotta go listen to them, because we talk about sex after menopause. And just like your brain, right? It needs blood flow, it needs nutrients to function. Your sex organs, your pelvic floor are the same way. Yeah. You have to continually stimulate that tissue. You have to do all the things that bring blood flow to those nerve endings and optimize the hormones and all of these things. To keep them, you know, it's like use it or lose it, and don't let menopause be, you know, the lose it for you if you don't want to.
That's right. So yes, I talk all in my book about busting out the vibrators, even if sex is painful for the moment, until you have brought in your vaginal estrogen. Vibrators can be wonderful, you know, stimulating the clitoris and getting that orgasm. It's like crunches for your vaginal walls. So even if it's painful by through penetration, definitely external stimulation can be really helpful. Yeah. And yes, women's
sex should not be painful. It should not be painful. And but, yeah, go ahead.
What did they say? I'm curious. What did they say? These experts say about how like women just don't even want it anymore. They're like, nope, I'm done. Did they talk about like connection and intimacy with your partner as well?
Yeah. Yeah. So women, I think, believe that we should have spontaneous desire. And this goes for premenopausal women too. Very different than men. Men have spontaneous desire. They wake up in the morning, they have an erection. They're like, I want to have sex today. Women don't have that. And that is very normal. What women have is receptive desire, meaning that if they have some arousal, if the dishes are done and the lights are down and the candle is going, and they're like, oh, I'm kind of more open to this. And then as soon as they get some physical stimulation and arousal, they start to have more desire. But women, a lot of times, way our brains work, just like you kind of said, like my brain has a lot, it's doing a lot of things. It's multitasking. And we never get into that space. We never allow ourselves to get into that space. And, you know, it's kind of like meditation. Like we don't like being in this like quiet alone place with ourselves. And so a lot of times we're not really broken. There's nothing wrong with us. We just have not prioritized this area of our relationship for a long time. And so many of these experts kind of said the same thing. So many women who come into my clinic think that when I say, you know, how is your sexual function? A lot of women think that their sex life revolves around penis and vagina intercourse. And it's just so much more than that. And for a lot of women who have pain with intercourse, yes, after menopause, a lot of it is due to lack of lubrication and the need for vaginal estrogen. But a lot of women, even premenopausal women who have pain with intercourse, it's almost always attempting penetration without arousal. Mm. And women need arousal. You need massage of the vulva. You need stimulation of the clitoris. You need lubrication. You need arousal to start bringing that blood flow to that. It's like a man trying to have sex without an erection. They don't try to do that, right? Like they wait till there's an erection. It's the same thing with women. You're trying to have penetrative intercourse when you don't have an erection. And so you need arousal for that to happen. And a lot of people are just skipping right over that. And they're like, let's just have sex. Let's get it over with it. Let's be done. Because a lot of times they're just doing it for their partner.
Right.
But, and yeah.
And that's how it's shown in the movie. It's like, there's no 100% foreplay.
Hollywood
it's
sex.
Hollywood sex, instant penetration, banging up against the wall. And I'm like, that's actually, I wish it would be portrayed like the 40-year-old virgin, right? We're fumbling and condoms are flying everywhere. And it's bumpy and awkward the way it is in real life. But the other thing also I see is women not wanting to have sex because they've gained weight and they feel really self-conscious about their bodies. And I'm telling you, ladies, not a man out there has ever complained and said, wow, it seems like you got some more cellulite, or woo, you're really rocking that rubber tire like around your midsection. Like they're just so happy to have a warm, naked human in front of them who they love and are still partnered with after all these years. So, really, if you need to buy some lingerie or a nightgown or top that makes you feel less self-conscious, that's fine. But I promise you, like, no one, it's really about, again, the connection and the human you are, and not just the fact that you've gained a few pounds during menopause. So also, I like to put that out there as well.
100%. I am totally with you. Like, I'm like, if I'm walking into the bedroom, like, I want my hair to look nice. I want to be showered, right? Because that's how I feel sexy. I will tell you right now, men are primal creatures. And my husband, like if I come home sweaty from the gym and I've got like the ponytail that's like falling off the side of my head, he is like, let's go. And I'm like, oh, bro, like you're so gross. Like, you know, or like I'm in a phase right now where I'm trying to build muscle. I'm the heaviest I've been in a really long time. And my husband's like, dude, I love this. Like I am into this. Like, and, but I can't remember which sex expert it was on my podcast, but she said, ladies, you cannot orgasm trying to hold your stomach in. And I was like, well, it's so true though, right? Like sometimes we, with our own long-term monogamous partner, get into situations where we're like, oh, like, I don't want him to see me like this, or you're trying to suck your stomach in, or you're trying to like, when half the time, like they don't care, and you need to let yourself relax and you need to get into the moment and you need to feel that deep, intimate connection with your partners or with yourself, right? Like how many women have, I've had women who are like, I can't have an orgasm. And I'm like, okay, well, we're going to start with yourself, touch your own body, get a mirror, look at it. What feels good to you? Until you know how your body, how your car turns on, you can't be letting other people drive it. And we have to figure out how to get into that space in our own heads, because so much of sexual function is actually in our brain. Orgasm is a brain thing.
Oh, it's such a brain thing. And the other thing is that while you're busy trying to hold in your stomach, like your partner's actually looking to see if you are aroused, because they often can't orgasm until they see you, or at least you're, you know, into it and in the moment and very present. So that is, you know, it's, no one's looking at your belly. They're really not.
Okay. So we're going to go to the semen analysis, you guys. And I pulled the North American Menopause Society just released. They do updated guidelines every couple of years for hormone therapy. And I just had to take like a complete slow clap when they released their 2022 statement, because for so long, Western medicine has been, you know, we saw these big trials, WHI and the nurse health studies, that really scared a lot of practitioners away from hormone therapy and really honestly from addressing menopause in general. And although NAMS, the North American Menopause Society, has been around for a long time, they still have been very conservative about the use of hormone therapy. And now we're kind of seeing the pendulum swing. And we saw that with their 2022 statement. So basically, since their last position statement, which was in 2017, there were some really important additions that kind of clarified the balance of risk and benefit with hormone therapy for menopause symptoms. And they kind of said, after exhaustive research and review of the literature over the past 5 years, we found what hasn't changed is that hormone therapy is the most effective treatment for vasomotor symptoms, which are hot flashes and night sweats, and genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which is basically recurrent UTIs, pain with intercourse, vaginal dryness, and has been shown to prevent bone loss and fracture. So the highlights from it were basically risk stratification should be done by age and time since menopause. So you kind of alluded to that. At the time of menopause, even a couple years prior to menopause and 10 years after menopause are the least risky times for initiation of hormone therapy. That is when you should be talking to your provider about testing, about getting on something. Transdermal routes of administration, which means through the skin, or something sublingual. So these are like creams, gels, patches. These are all decreased risk of blood clot and stroke, which for many years was a risk for people. So oral estrogens can increase the risk of blood clot and stroke. It's particularly for over the age of 65, obese women, and usually smokers. But just know that there are safe routes of administration that don't have that risk. Low-dose vaginal estrogen therapy appears safe and effective even for breast cancer and endometrial cancer patients.
Yes.
I'm going to say that one more time.
Low-dose
vaginal estrogen therapy for treatment of genitourinary syndrome of menopause is safe and effective for select survivors of breast and endometrial cancer. So please, if you have had one of these cancers and you are suffering from vaginal dryness, recurrent urinary tract infections, inability to have a sexual relationship with your partner, please find a provider that is supportive, because almost every oncologist still doesn't understand these recommendations, and they will 100% dismiss you and tell you absolutely not. But it is an option for you. Breast cancer risk does not increase appreciably with short-term use of estrogen progesterone therapy and may be decreased with estrogen alone. Now I want to unpack that just slightly. There was a great meta-analysis that came out in 2022 that showed that the only population that has an increased risk of breast cancer is people taking estrogen and a progesterone, but it was very specifically a progestin, which is a synthetic progesterone, you can get bioidentical micronized progesterone in a capsule form, in a cream form, in a sublingual form. And that has not been shown in the studies to increase that risk. Compounded hormones do have safety concerns. And to unpack that a little bit further, you can get bioidentical forms of hormones in prescription form. So 17 beta estradiol, which is the natural bioidentical estrogen, it actually comes in pill form. It comes in patch form, and you can get it in compounded versions as well. But just because it's compounded doesn't mean it's bioidentical. The safety concerns with compounding is that you're trusting a human to put a concoction into a cream or a troche or an oral dissolving tablet or whatever it is. And there could be inaccuracies with measurements, and it's not FDA regulated. So nobody's checking those measurements. So basically you need to trust your compounding pharmacist, and you should have your levels checked to make sure that they're not getting excessively, you know, high out of physiologic range, or whatnot. And then for women with genitourinary syndrome of menopause, once again, vaginal dryness, recurrent UTIs, vaginal estrogen and systemic, if required, or another non-estrogen therapy. So this would be like vaginal DHEA, may be used at any age for an extended duration. And they even said in here, you know, women over the age of 65 could be on this basically until the day they die. So vaginal estrogen therapy, every single woman should be on it basically until the day she dies. I mean, if you go to Instagram and you see Kelly Kasperson, you're a gynecologist, all these different, I mean, these are medical doctors. Rachel Rubin, I could just keep naming them off, all yes. Huge fans of this because we see the clinical ramifications of this, and women have just not been getting good information about it. So for the semen analysis, you guys,
you're
going to have to re-listen to that. I know. I was super proud of NAMS and what they put out, because that is, yes, that is one of the most legitimate resources that medical doctors use when they are looking for information, you know, for their patients. And so you guys can use it too. That's the cool thing about the World Wide Web. You can go find the 2022 NAMS position statement. Yes. If you didn't understand what I just said, you can go read it for yourself. But
Just one more quick question. What is it going to take to get this taught in medical school?
Well, you know, they do talk about menopause. You know, they talk about it because it's this physiologic process. The problem is that in medical school, everything is very pathology driven. So something that's a physiologic process, right? Like we know that it happens, but you know, we're looking for pathology, and really, you know, they've really said it's just the hot flashes and night sweats. It's just the quality of life issue. That's all it is. When really, you know, although it's a physiologic process, it can become pathologic, right? The loss of bone, you know, increased risk of osteoporosis, increased risk of dementia, increased risk of cardiovascular disease. I mean, these are the things that are actually going to kill us and make our lives miserable. And so, you know, hormone therapy is really an anti-aging modality. And I heard this incredible fact the other day from like a longevity expert, and they were saying, if we could figure out how to decrease our aging, even by 1 year, which hormone therapy could essentially do, we could save on a worldwide population level $38 trillion because of the expense of aging in our population. In the last 5-10 years of our life, we're spending so much money in and out of hospitals and surgeries and medications and all of these things, you know, before we eventually die. So all the things that we've talked about today, nutrition, exercise, intermittent fasting, avoiding alcohol, optimizing hormone therapy, these are anti-aging modalities. And like I said, menopause is that accelerated aging. And so if you don't address these things, you're on the fast track. That's the unfortunate part.
Yeah.
Well, Esther, this has been so awesome. So tell people where they can find you, where they can find your books, how they can work with you if they want to.
Yes. So please follow me on Instagram at gorgeousester. And you can go to my website, estherblum.com, and get on my list, because not only do I offer one-on-one coaching, but I'm going to be starting a 6-week menopause mentorship group coaching program, which is going to be transformative and life-changing. So you're absolutely going to want to get on the priority notification list for that too.
Love
and
it.
Of course, buy my book. See you later, Ovulator.
What a fun, catchy name.
Thank you.
That is so fun. Well, thank you guys for listening, and make sure you download the podcast, leave us your review, share this with people. We depend on all of you to get these messages out to the world. We'll catch you on the next episode. Did you guys love that last episode of the Fit and Fabulous podcast? Well, of course you did. And I want to keep bringing you the most amazing content from the most incredible people. And you can help me by subscribing to the Dr. Fit and Fabulous channel. You guys know where the button is. Just click it. It's the doctor's orders.